This is episode 01 of Free As in Freedom. Hi, this is Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is Free As in Freedom.
Yes, this is the first actual official Free As in Freedom show.
It's true.
Hey, your chairs are noisy. I wonder if they're going to come through.
I bet they will. Okay. We've had enough technical mishaps already.
Well, yeah, so we said we were going to have a show a week and a half ago, and the reason we didn't was all the recordings we made had an audio buzz that was apparently from the power on a laptop. And so now
we had to do it again.
Well, we're doing it again. And I don't have the laptop plugged in.
Our personal professional engineer is out of town.
Well, and Dan said he could do nothing with the audio.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah. So nothing could be done. And now we're recording without a laptop, with the laptop unplugged.
It almost sounds like recording without a license.
Well, and I'm worried the laptop battery is going to go dead while we're recording. So
it's weird saying the word recording so many times when, our laptop stand is actually two books about recording technologies.
Well, would it tell us how to fix this power
thing? I don't know. One is called the Handbook of Recording Engineering. It might actually.
Well, I think just leaving it unplugged for now. I guess I'll charge it in between segments or something.
I guess so.
Well, so yeah, we're obviously in new facilities.
Bear with us.
Which is Karen's apartment. and with squeaky chairs. And and so we're using my laptop, which is not the laptop we used to use, and maybe that's why we had the problem.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, we used my laptop last time, which wasn't the laptop we used to use either, but
that's true, but when we tested with my laptop with it plugged in, we had the same problem.
That's true.
So it's the power system in this building. That's what I think.
That's weird.
Well, no, it's it could be at whatever, cuz the things don't stay at the right frequency necessarily. The frequencies drift a little bit. So it's drifted to just the right frequency that is causing a problem.
Do you know what's sad? What's sad is that we recorded a whole podcast and we just can't use it.
That's true. We could just re-say it all.
We could, but we wouldn't do that.
We could put our headphones on and play it and then just say the same things we said before.
Like an audio dub?
I guess, yeah. Or we could put it into a teleprompter. We could transcribe it and...
It really wasn't that good.
No, it wasn't worth saving, I guess, but... Now there's been new topics and we'll have to cover them.
Yeah. Yeah. Although we should cover some of the topics we talked about because I think they're of interest to our listeners. For example, the licensing of the show.
Well, I finally have convinced you.
I don't know if you convinced me so much as I just thought about it a lot more. And
maybe... Carl Fogel convinced you.
No.
Carl agrees with me.
Although I looked up at my door and I have a question copyright logo on.
Yeah, so for our listeners, Carl Fogel is the executive director, is that his title?
Yeah, and founder.
Of.
And I think he's president too, but I'm not sure.
Well, like me in Conservancy, he's president and founder.
And Eben with the Software Freedom Law Center.
Yeah, but he has that weird title, like director, counsel, or something. Whatever the hell that means.
Well, it just means he's a lawyer too, that's true.
So, but Carl Fogel is with Question Copyright, and he believes in being allowed to modify works.
And like I'm also counsel to Question Copyright.
Yeah,
so.
You were pro no derives for
so long.
No,
I wasn't pro no derives. I just, I was basically, and I've actually talked to Nina Paley, who is a vehement copyright abolitionist about this. And it's trying to use copyright to accomplish something completely unrelated to copyright.
That's what I said.
And sometimes it's appropriate. Like sometimes I think it's useful to do that. Use one legal regime to accomplish something in another, but it often is not. And I think in this instance, it's a little overboard.
You're always worried about people misrepresenting you. Taking each word and putting it together to say, Karen Sandler said,
to the extent
I believe that there is no copyright.
Well, to the extent that
I think software patents are great.
That we sometimes talk about, you know, legal topics and I'm a lawyer, I worry about being construed as giving legal advice. And for all of our listeners, this is not legal advice. I don't know how many times I'm going to say that over the course of the show, but I said it a lot over the Software Freedom Law Show.
Yeah, and then they couldn't even make derivatives then. So now that they can make derivative works, you're going to say it even more?
I might.
Are you more worried? Are you really? No, are you really worried? I want to know. Are you really more worried now that people are going to do something that misrepresents you? Do you think the change in license really creates a worry that there's something worse that can happen now?
Well, I don't know about that. I just want to be really careful always to make sure that people understand me clearly and understand what our relationship is, and especially where.
Well, I couldn't understand clearly last time because it was this audio buzzer.
Yeah, but where, you know, where there is no legal relationship, where I'm not, I don't know the facts of any particular situation of our listeners. I don't want someone to think that because I gave a general opinion about an issue that it may apply to their particular situation, where I, you know, some, there may be some fact that makes it inapplicable. So, you know, I just worry about that. And I know we have a few lawyer listeners, and I'm sure that they feel similarly.
But that issue you just described, isn't that the same if there's no derives versus derivatives in some sense? Because if people listen to it and think that they can take some sort of legal advice from you, they would do that.
No, it is a problem, but no derives at least means that it stays whole. So it comes with all of my caveats and comes with the complete context of conversation. It's, you know, I mean, truth be told, under copyright law, you can excerpt pieces of what I said for a variety of uses under fair use.
In fact, they could take even much smaller pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
And not attribute them properly.
I mean, you know, so there are exceptions to, you know, to or safe harbors in the copyright law for that. So, you know,
but the fair use situation is much more scary. I mean, this is the, for example, this is the Daily Show thing of taking people out of context and just taking a very small clip, which is fair use there. They don't have a right to make that as a derivative work. So
yeah,
that's actually,
well, that's what I'm
fair
saying.
Fair use thing seems a bigger issue.
Well,
that is
what I'm saying. But at the same time, if someone were to present what I said, you know, in a larger part. As I said, I wasn't convinced that it was really the right answer, which is why I agreed to change the license of the show. It just, I don't know, maybe it's just the lawyer instinct in me to be cautious.
To use these powerful legal regimes against our listeners?
No.
That's what failing to allow people to make derivative works really does.
No, I'm all about sharing, I promise.
Yeah. Well, so now people are going to write in and ask me about the FDL and variant sections.
Yep.
Yeah. So especially
I almost mentioned it, but I.
Well, I
just didn't think we wanted to.
I don't mind mentioning it. I think that.
Have you looked at the? I think it's freedefinition.org. The free definitions for free culture.
Yeah, I saw you mention that at one point on something else, and I hadn't looked at it in detail.
Okay. Well, I just think it's interesting because of the way it talks about the invariant sections of the FDL as well. But what I like about what they've done there is that they are clearly inspired by what Richard Stallman and the FSF has done with the free definitions and software and brought them over to free culture in a way that I think pretty much works. I mean, I don't know. It's not as tested. So,
will it work to convince free culture people to stop using Macs? Because that's my big beef with free culture is that they tend to prefer Macs.
Yeah, and it's an objection I have as well. But
did I ever tell you that Larry Lessig showed up to give a keynote at a FSF event using a Mac?
You did not tell me that.
He was on the board of directors of FSF. Yeah, that didn't. That
did I tell you about
that? Didn't work out so well.
The lawyer that presented to a Linux Foundation collaboration summit with the a Windows laptop, but it was not only a Windows laptop. But while he was talking, it went into screensaver mode, and he had never changed the screensaver away from the Windows logo. So while he was talking about about standards and you know, OXML, there was this, I'm not saying who it is.
Everybody knows who it is.
There are a lot of people who
about could, standards.
Tons
who
of
could
lawyers,
that be?
Tons of lawyers presented the Linux Foundation, some, you know, various things.
Yeah, I know.
Things.
I know but, who this is, just by context.
But there was, there was amazing watching the Windows logo bounce in the background.
Yeah, it's disturbing, as Fontana and I would say, Fontana also being a lawyer who doesn't use Windows, like you, he would say this is disturbing how many lawyers use Windows. He was telling me, you know, he said this publicly actually, that there are lawyers at Red Hat who use Windows.
Oh, really?
Windows. Yeah.
Wow. Now, to be fair, perhaps the lawyer that that was giving this presentation work at law firms that have standardized choices for computers and operating systems, and it's very, very difficult to get them to make exceptions. So sometimes they're just in order to keep their job at their law firm, they must keep using that system or that proprietary software.
If somebody made me use proprietary software for my job, I would quit.
Well, naturally, you would.
Well, why wouldn't everybody? See, if everybody would do that, then there would be no proprietary software laws.
Well, that's for sure.
So everybody needs to do
that. That's the way I completely agree. I mean, that's the way we can solve a lot of problems, is just through mere consumerism. If we vote with our money and vote with our choices, you know, that solves the problem.
Well, that's not really consumerism. That's basically saying, consumerism would be different. That's not buying Windows yourself. Right, which I think most people in the free software world.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, refusing to use.
That's not. I wouldn't call it consumer choices when you say.
But it becomes a consumer choice, because that law firm then has to reevaluate what its choices are and what licenses it's going to choose or buy. It is consumerism.
I don't know if I want to believe that, but you could be right. But.
But I mean, that's how we can effectuate change. We just all have to make good choices.
So you have to. I see. Stallman convinced me of this very early on, and I have not changed my mind since I heard him say it. Which was that he makes this joke in his talks about. He puts it. He says, when I realized that I thought writing proprietary software was wrong, I had to decide whether I could still do it because I thought it was wrong. And the question, obviously, is, can I get any other job? And then, as he says it, I realized I could be a waiter. I wouldn't be a very good waiter, but I could do the job. Therefore, it's not required to live to write proprietary software. And I decided the same thing, that I would never produce proprietary software because I can always find a job as a waiter, or I probably work at a coffee shop. But
yeah, I mean, you know, that's an exaggerated example, but I think we all strive to make those kinds of choices in our lives.
I think a lot of people insist on working in their field. I think a lot of people have a lot of pride. And if they can't get a job, I talk to a lot of developers who have this attitude. They will try to get a job writing free software, and if they can't, they will decide that they're going to take a job writing proprietary software.
Yeah, but a lot of developers don't feel moral about free software in the way that we do.
Some of them I meet do. Some of them I meet, they try really hard and then just decide that they've made a moral choice that staying in their field is more important than the morality of free
software. Right, a sense of identity.
Yeah. And from my point of view, if my field is not going to let me do what I think is right for the field, the reason I got into free software in the first place is, as a computer scientist, I felt that it was wrong for computer science to ever do or have proprietary software. So why would I be part of the regime that's destroying computer science? I think proprietary software destroys computer science because it takes away students' abilities to learn about software. And that was how I first came to it, because I was just out of school when I first got into this. So.
Now, to defend the Mac users, because there are a few Mac users that I know who are working on some good stuff and working on some really good free software for Mac use, I just think that I think that using Macs and creating free software for popular platforms is an important part of the advocacy for free and open source software.
I think it's complicated. There are some cases where you're able to move people off of major proprietary applications. So the classic example is OpenOffice developers, or LibreOffice developers these days, working to make sure it works okay on Windows and Mac, as well as GNU Linux systems. There's, I suppose, an argument for that if you can sell one less proprietary program, if somebody's still buying a Windows license but isn't buying a Microsoft Word license, you've improved things somewhat. And the same goes for things like Firefox and other browsers that run on other platforms.
But also, you know, a taste of good free software is often the first step.
Yeah, well, I hope the LibreOffice guys are able to make that stuff good. Quite honestly, I've never been that thought Open Office was all that good. But now that they forked, it's good news because there's probably going to be much more improvement.
I mean, I have to say that when I show people, when I tell people who have never heard about free software, don't understand free software, and I tell them about it, and I tell them to start out with small programs, start out with using, for example, Pigeon or OpenOffice, not a small program, but one piece, and they see Firefox and they see that it's good, then they are much more open to the whole idea. They think it's really cool.
See, I always felt the other way was better. So one of the reasons I'm supportive of the Wine Project is I felt that getting people switched to a free software platform and then the few legacy applications that are proprietary they felt they had to use, letting them use them on the free platform is better.
Well, that's a completely different issue. I mean, if there's no tool to do the job that's free and open source, then there's no tool to do the job, and we need something like Wine so that we can use those legacy programs. I mean, I just think that's a slightly different issue.
See, I think it's the same issue in the sense that your goal is to get people to use mostly, you realize if you can't get people to use 100% free software, right? Most people I know who are already using GNU Linux, I advocate for them to use 100% free software because they've come so far that they probably won't have that much inconvenience from it. But those who have never are still using proprietary software all day, every day, for those people, it makes sense to try and find a way they can use some free software and
that is what I'm talking about.
But that's the same question.
Just to introduce,
right?
Some free software into what they're using so that they get comfortable with the idea and excited about it.
See, the reason I think that the Wine approach, that it's the same problem, the Wine approach is better, is because if you swap out for a GNU Linux system underneath, everything they're going to be installing mostly, when they go into their search for programs to install, they'll find mostly free software and all that sort of thing. So if they have a few proprietary applications on GNU Linux, it's much better than having a few free programs on Windows.
It's such a hump to get people to even try it out. Mm. And they just won't if they haven't experienced some piece of it already.
Yeah, see, this is why I think that it's going to be so hard convincing non-technical people.
But I find that it's actually not so hard when you get one-on-one with people and you start to explain why freedom is important and they see that the software is good. Those two things together really make for a good sale, and people are much more willing to give it a shot. And once you get a taste, you want more.
I guess. But of course, this goes back to OpenOffice kind of sucking.
But I've actually not experienced that.
Okay. Well, I suppose I'm a bad judge because I converted my whole family
over to OpenOffice, and they're very happy with it. They've not once said to me that they missed Word.
Well, I've heard that OpenOffice runs better on Windows than GNU Linux. If you've gotten installed for people, have you seen that to be true? I don't know because I haven't used Windows since 1997.
I haven't. I've only used it myself on my GNU Linux.
But if you set it up for people.
And only on Mac.
You set it up for people on Mac.
They just have Macs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
my sister has a netbook that was Windows. Her netbook had Windows on it.
Did OpenOffice seem better on Windows?
It seemed the same to me, but I've always felt like it was good. So okay. It's always been pretty satisfactory.
That's actually been a complaint that I've heard from people. And I've heard this about Firefox too. And that's another thing I worry about is...
Oh, see, most of the people I know who switched to Firefox from Explorer were thrilled.
Oh, no, that I agree.
Because there's so many people using Explorer.
My point was
Safari to Firefox?
No, my point was Firefox runs better on Windows than it does on GNU Linux.
Is that true?
I've heard that from a lot of people. Hmm. Now, I this is all anecdotal. I haven't seen a usability study. I haven't seen anything statistically significant. But I've heard this from people and complaints that the GNU Linux version of Firefox is, and of OpenOffice for that matter, is sort of a stepchild of sorts. Hmm. So I think that's something I worry about too with these cross-platform applications. That we want the version on the free platform to run hopefully the best, equal at least. And I think that sometimes doesn't happen. I don't think Open Office, I want to judge it anymore because the LibreOffice guys are putting so much work in, and I just saw some data recently that they have so many more commits.
No, it's just upsetting to hear you talk about Open Office negatively when I've actually had a really good experience with it.
Okay. Well, I like I said, I'm withholding judgment now because the whole community has changed, and now there's actually a free software community forming around it through the Document Foundation, and they published a list of how many commits they're getting, and they're getting more commits than they did in the last year or something like that. So they just got more.
That's
people
great.
Involved.
No, I really look forward to seeing what happens. I was happy before, so maybe I'll be even happier.
Well, yeah. Do you really want Oracle controlling your free software? Even if it's free software, do you really want Oracle in control of it?
I mean, I don't advocate for company control of free. I mean, you phrase that question in such a loaded way.
I think my point is that judgments about Open Office had to change because of the Oracle acquisition of Sun.
I don't know. I mean, we're just talking about the quality of the software itself and using it. And I'm saying that I had a good experience with it and that software was available and there were forks. Mm. There were, you know, less official forks before. Mm. So that is the function of a free and open source software project. That is in some ways success. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
True. I think
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I'm supportive of, you know, of a nonprofit driven community for sure. Absolutely. And especially if it has diversified interests that are not entirely contained in one company. But, you know, that doesn't mean that to the extent that software is developed within a company and released and there is community activity, that's not good too.
Yeah, I'm distrustful of the way that OpenOffice operated and the proprietary forks that continued. And that was true at Sun as well, for that matter. It's not like that's new to Oracle, but Oracle's sort of the master of subjugating users. So Microsoft's the only one who's better at it than them. Maybe Apple, but they're certainly in the top three. What? It's true. This is what these companies do.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just
you're laughing at me.
Well, I'm not laughing at you. I just, you know,
you're not laughing with me.
Well, I wouldn't.
So you must be laughing.
Well, I wouldn't talk about. I don't think I would couch it in terms of subjugating users. I just
see. I believe that about proprietary software.
No, I too agree with that about proprietary software. But we're actually not talking about proprietary software now. We're talking about OpenOffice.
So my argument would be that companies who have this long history of using proprietary software to subjugate users, when they get involved with open source, and I say open source on purpose there, they're likely to try and port what they used to do in proprietary software over. And I think that's something that's happened.
I just don't want to make any blanket statements because I really want to take each company at its actions.
Yeah, but most of Oracle's actions have been bad. The only thing I've seen Oracle do that's been positive is they have one developer who's been working on ButterFS and has been contributing that to Linux. And that's been true since before the Sun acquisition. But that's the only thing I've seen Oracle do that is really in the spirit of free software. Ever in their history. Even the stuff that they've done since they bought Sun has all been basically negative and harmful to the communities that were there.
I mean, I'm just talking about the specific...
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is a specific version of OpenOffice that you got it probably from Debian.
Yeah.
And it worked well for you. And
yeah.
So as a software program by itself, it sort of considered in the void. Well, not in the void,
yeah,
running
on
the system.
I'm very hesitant to applaud new projects and forks until they've really done something. And I've been that way. I'm really excited about new projects and forks that are, you know, heartfelt and have, you know, momentum and enthusiasm behind them. I don't want to slag off a piece of software that I've been using happily with success when, you know, the new thing hasn't happened yet. And I look forward to it happening and seeing
a
better
version.
Well, it is happening, but it hasn't happened yet.
Well, it has happened. It's just you're not running out of trunk, basically. So you
fair
wouldn't
enough.
You wouldn't be able to judge if it's better or worse
fair,
yet.
Fair enough.
You just can't judge because you're actually like me in this regard because you wait until something's actually packaged in the stable version of a distribution.
Yeah, that's true.
And so it'll be a long time before, it'd be a really long time before I do, because I only use OpenOffice to dump things out into text files so I can actually read them using a normal
basically
program.
Files that I send to you.
Yeah, I've converted some of your files recently.
I've noticed. And then you send them to me without providing a diff.
Well, I couldn't, because I couldn't diff against the OpenOffice format, because you had
but you didn't diff against the version that you converted.
Oh, I guess that's true.
That's what I found to be so objectionable, because you converted its format and then you didn't. Basically, my only choice would be to either convert it back to OpenOffice or convert my OpenOffice version to tech and run a diff.
I think, actually, there never was, in that particular document you're talking about, there never was a version that was in LaTeX that was yours, because I did the LaTeX conversion
while
as
you
I
made
did my
the
edits.
Changes.
So you could diff it against the text file, I guess. I did commit the text file intermittently, which I admit I didn't send to you.
Yeah, but, you know.
I intermittently committed that text file and then reformatted it while I made the changes.
I mean, I had no problem using tech anyway. I just was using legacy documents that were in OpenOffice.
But they're legacy documents you created. You made the legacy.
No, but I created them from other documents. Almost every document that I created was from another document.
Okay. Well, that's fine. But I'm giving up on it.
Some of them actually started in doc format.
How did that happen?
Because I took them from a long time ago in another world, another galaxy.
Okay.
Far, far away.
Okay, well, so we should wrap up this segment. Not that the segment had a theme of any kind.
No, but it was fun.
Okay, so we'll see how long this was, and then do another segment of some length.
Great.
So in the last segment, you were mentioning these programs that are designed to make things work on different operating systems, free software.
Is that some of the software by the members of the Conservancy, which you are now full-time at?
That is correct. That's why I brought it up, because I was recently at a projects conference who is like that. I went 2 weeks ago to 2 weekends ago to the jQuery conference in Boston. And jQuery is that kind of project. They're designed, there was a lot of Macs there. It really kind of freaked me out.
But there were so many Macs at the Linux Foundation.
Well, the Macs at Linux Foundation meet, that is freaking weird. Although there are, I know David Woodhouse, he's a great example of someone. He's always used Mac hardware to run Linux on. So,
right, but usually when you peer over somebody's shoulder enough to just to see what they're running.
You see OS
X. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, there are some hardcore people who like the Mac hardware and run GNU Linux on the Mac hardware.
And our intern, Laura Moy, was able to, she put, I don't remember what she put, I think just Debian on her, maybe it was Ubuntu actually, on her Mac. She wrote a blog post about it, which I'll link to in the notes.
So jQuery is one of these projects, because their goal is to make software that you write in JavaScript run exactly the same and gracefully degrade on all browsers of all kinds, including in Lynx. So it's all HTML. When you write jQuery, your core documents are all HTML, and then they call out to jQuery, and if you load it in with Lynx or some other text-based browser, you still get something reasonable. But if you have a browser that supports JavaScript, you will get a variety of different stuff, animations, all sorts of things that are possible in JavaScript, and jQuery makes them all work on all the different browsers.
And that's why it's incredibly popular.
Yeah, it's a very popular project, and it's designed, it's growing incredibly fast. It's quickly becoming the biggest project in Conservancy, and so it's things to think about with that. You don't want too much. I've said this before. I think that we don't want the Conservancy to be so big that it is basically a lawsuit target.
You don't want its pockets to be too deep.
Right. So if somebody decides one of the Conservancy projects is infringing some patent, they might decide, wow, there's enough money here that we could sue and make it valuable.
Make it worth our while.
Yeah. To try and take all their money away. So that's something to worry about, but we're not there yet, but we may have to worry about that in the future. But in the meantime,
it's very unattractive. You know, nonprofits tend to be unattractive targets because you look like the big bad when you start to sue nonprofits.
Yeah. But that happens. It still happens.
No, they do. I mean, that's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. So how was the conference?
So it's really good. It's funny because those who read my blog know that I said some recent things about Shuttleworth. And in fact, I posted that the day I was at the jQuery conference, and the communities are so non-overlapping that nobody there had even noticed that there was that I created this big giant news thing about Mark Shuttleworth and his love of proprietary relicensing. And nobody there is into that world. It's not a heavy overlap. I somebody walked up to me and asked me what I was running because they saw my screen and they had never seen a GNU Linux system, particularly one as minimally configured as mine. Yeah, a lot of the attendees were web developers who work mostly on Mac and Windows using jQuery. Yeah,
they didn't even know what you were running.
Yeah, well, although my screen looks a little strange because it's Sawfish and Emacs and all that. But
still, when you see a screen that looks generally like that, you know.
I mean,
like,
it must be some neckbearded Linux dude. Although my neck beard was well shaved, like it is. Although I'm growing my beard in, by the way, I've decided I should have more beard going on. So we'll see how that works out.
That's very hipster of you.
I have to try that again. So, but yeah, but still not growing a neck beard. But anyway, the neck beard attitude of the
you just
GNU
want to
Linux
say neck beard as many times as
well,
possible.
Because that was the whole thing. That was the whole Ubuntu. OMG Ubuntu thing that happened a couple of months ago. Anyway, so there's people there who didn't know what a GNU Linux system looked like, which is fine. And they're, in the sense that they're coming to free software, it's sort of what you were talking about in the last segment, that they're coming to free software from the line of jQuery. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of new people learning about the whole idea of free software through jQuery. One of the interesting things happening in their community is because they're under a permissive license, there are a lot of proprietarization stuff going on at all the companies. And there's interesting pressure in the community to release more. And so I sort of see them as evolving as a free software community. They don't have sort of the backstory that other free software communities have because they're young as a community, but they're sort of going through the same trials and all the outcomes seem to be coming out right. For example, multiple companies announced at the conference they'd be releasing jQuery derivatives or basically plugins for jQuery that had previously been proprietary. Two different companies announced that during the conference.
That's great.
So I think that there is some change going on and that community is becoming more of a free software community. Obviously the core of jQuery, because they're a conservancy member, all the core and actually jQuery core and jQuery UI, which are the two primary libraries that are the conservancy members, those are all free software, of course, but there's lots obviously of proprietarization around them, mm-hmm. Which is unfortunate to see, but they're hoping to do more and they're hoping to improve the widget set inside jQuery so that there's fewer places for proprietarization.
Were they all technical talks at the conference?
Mostly, yeah. Some of them, because of my limited knowledge of JavaScript, they were actually challenging for me to sit in on because I don't know JavaScript well enough. At one point, it was that weird feeling where somebody put a slide up and said, "Does this make sense to everybody?" And I didn't want to raise my hand that I was the only one that didn't. But by the time he finished talking through that slide, I understood what it was doing because I just don't understand some of the library calls well enough to know. A lot of the things you do in jQuery is you set up events to happen on certain occurrences, like the classic thing is a mouse over. When you mouse over something happens and it runs a function and all that sort of stuff. And so there's all these predefined events in jQuery that you can hook things into. And if you don't know those off the top of your head, you have trouble reading code and saying, well, when does that event happen and what and so forth.
So do you feel like you learned a lot?
I learned some. I got sick, unfortunately, while I was there, so I didn't actually see as many talks as I wanted to on Sunday. But I learned a few things I learned more about the community, really. And that was there not necessarily to learn JavaScript myself and learn jQuery myself, but to learn about the community. And on that front, I learned a lot about how this community operates.
Well, that's a cool thing about you being full-time at Conservancy is now you can do that. You can take some time to be involved with all of the Conservancy member projects to the extent they're open and interested to it.
Yeah, and also I think it's important that Conservancy understand its communities, and certainly jQuery is probably the community I understood the least. Actually, that's not true. I probably don't understand the wine community all that well because it's not a program I use and it's not something that I think about. But probably somewhere between wine and jQuery that are the two communities that I understand the least. Even Samba, which I don't use anymore because I don't connect up with Windows machines anymore. Mm-hmm. Years ago in my career, I was an early Samba user because I used to work, like when I worked at Westinghouse, we had to connect up to the Windows file service and stuff. And actually all the engineers were very happy when I got some SMB client running so that they could get the files onto the Unix machines easily off of the Windows server. So I, even Samba I'm familiar with from way back when. Obviously it's changed a great deal since then, but. So that was the jQuery conference. I was there. It's good actually, because there are conferences on weekends. Cause I think a lot of people, you and I go to conferences a lot during the week because our jobs basically allow us to do so.
Most conferences are actually on the weekend. Most of the ones I've been to.
Oh, really?
I've been on the weekend.
Yeah. Cause we've been together at a lot of the, like OSCON classically is during the week. And the Linux Foundation events are always during the week. And
are they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking of a few other conferences right now that are
on the weekend.
But I think like Scale is a weekend conference.
Well, Scale I think is unique.
Although Scale does have its Women in Free Software Day. I actually think they call it Women Open Source Day on Friday.
Yeah.
Which.
Well, it's, but I think
I like Scale a lot, but that's one thing I would change.
Yeah. I don't like being away during the weekends and such, cause it's always tough to travel on the weekends. But, on the other hand, I'm glad that there are so many conferences on weekends because that's, if you're an enthusiast, if you're not somebody who it's your full-time job to be involved in open source and free software, then it's difficult. You have to take vacation days.
Well, that's right. It encourages, enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And that's really important.
And so while I hate this, I just last 2 weekends in a row, I was away on the weekend. I'm glad that they're doing it. And the other, so last weekend, the conference I was at was the Google Mentor Summit for the Summer of Code Mentors.
Oh, cool.
Which was interesting.
Actually, I knew you were going to that. I just forgot.
So
don't laugh.
Yeah, well, I told you I was going.
So, but was the conference part productive?
I think so. I there was a lot of discussion. Apparently, it's actually kind of weird. There were 300 slots for mentors to attend the Summer of Code Mentor Summit, and they said they only had 230 people actually come. Hmm. So it was a little bit strange because it was basically a not all expenses paid, but flight paid and hotel paid trip to Google for the weekend, mm-hmm. because Google paid for the hotel for 2 nights and flights for everyone.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they do that for them. That's part of the mentor funding. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising that people turned it down. I think there was a lot of discussion, and particularly in the final session where Carol was basically saying, is this really useful? You know, this is just an extra expense for us.
Yeah.
Do you guys want this? And of course, everybody there obviously wants it. And they were worried about the numbers and so forth. I think it was more of a communication question. I think people didn't know that they could do the first-time mentors, probably didn't know about it and so forth. And I actually committed during that session to doing more work in conservancy to explain to conservancy members what's available. Because that's a really important thing for a nonprofit to do when there's a funding opportunity available or something valuable for volunteers in your nonprofit, you want to let them know that they can take advantage of this program. So I think I could have done more in conservancy to let people know about the Mentor Summit and so forth, especially since I was going. So I committed to that during the thing. I'm actually going to help them write up. One of the things I'm going to help them write up is a tutorial for what orgs that have staff should be doing. Because there's...
Oh, that's great.
Because the thing is that the Carol... So you can say, I mean, I would be the type to say, Google's a big corporation and they should just do everything for us. But to some extent...
Well, that's
you've got
not
to
what
work,
you would say.
Well, I might. Okay. Some people would think I would say that.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that here because this is basically philanthropy. It's the same thing as getting money from a foundation or anything else. And you want to make it as easy as possible for people to give you money. You don't want to make it hard for them to have to do that. And so orgs that have... Then the orgs that are volunteers, I think Carol will have to take on the extra work because they're just all volunteers. And so, but for orgs like Conservancy, like Mozilla, there's other orgs with staff who participate. They really should take on some of the burden of the coordination. So I'm hoping to do that next year for Conservancy, both to encourage Conservancy members to take more advantage of the Summer of Code and the Mentor Summit, and also to just make it easier for Google to have an org. And when they know an org's in conservancy, they're more likely to accept it because they know it's not going to be a pain in the ass.
Sure.
Those sort of things. Because there's a lot of small orgs that get funding that don't have any staff or anything like that.
So how many conservancy member projects are represented at the Mentor Summit?
We're roughly about 10%. I don't know, because of this thing where not all the projects came, I didn't really count exactly of the ones that came. We usually go between 8 and 12% of Summer of Code is Conservancy member projects. That's been standard since around 2006. I didn't realize that. Well, it always gets there, because what happens is we get applications because of Summer of Code. Because the Summer of Code also gives the sponsoring organization $500 per mentor.
Right.
And that's often the first time a project must deal with money.
Yep.
And so.
And those people, and a lot of people just don't want to take that cash because they can't, they want to take it on behalf of the project, but they don't have any immediate expenses on behalf of the project, and they don't want to take it personally.
And some have, and they've had to pay taxes on it.
Well, they have to pay taxes on it, or sometimes they have, but then they spend it right away on some equipment or something.
Yeah, but they still have to.
They still have to pay taxes on it for sure. But at least, you know, I'm just saying that
it's in the same year and they can.
Yeah. And it's also like a perfectly appropriate and ethical handling of the money. Yeah. I didn't mean to suggest, for example, that if someone took it and took that money in personally, that it meant that the money was poorly handled.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't mean that. And in fact, there are people who just follow Schedule C and then take it as expenses because they have expenses for the project. But, that's obviously a tough thing to do. I know somebody in a project that's applying for a conservancy who's been doing that for not just the Google Summer of Code money, but many different income sources for the project. And he's been paying taxes on it, doing, and he does all the diligent work, but it's really a lot of work for him to do that. So they're joining conservancy to hopefully they won't have to do that anymore. But I think also a lot of people don't realize that Google will donate it to another org on your behalf. And people have never asked for it. They do that, and people have never asked for it. Like, if there's a nonprofit that your project decide that you don't have a nonprofit of your own, but you like some other nonprofit, Google will donate.
I didn't realize that either. That's great.
They will do that. And so a lot of people don't know that, and a lot of the mentor money goes unclaimed. People should make sure that your mentor money is claimed. If you're in conservancy, obviously, you've gotten a few emails from me already, and I'm still waiting for many of you to send me the info that I asked for to do the thing.
And if you have unclaimed funds, feel free to donate them to Conservancy or donate them to the Software Freedom Law Center
or the FSF
or any one of a number of free software nonprofits.
But the first thing you might think about doing, if you are in the Summer of Code and I didn't see you this weekend and you don't know what to do about the mentor payments, you should also apply for Conservancy. That's a classic reason that we get applications. So feel free, and we can hopefully work something out to make sure that you can get this year's money as well. We've done that in the past for projects to accept ahead of time before you're a member.
Great that you're encouraging people to apply for Conservancy now. In the past, before you were full-time at Conservancy, it was just one of those, you know, it was just a resources issue.
Yeah.
A volunteer organization just can't do as much as an organization with a full-time person.
Yeah, although it's been a tough month for me at Conservancy, because I did almost no Conservancy volunteer work in September, because there was so much stuff that had to be done to finish up SFLC. So I spent most of my time on stuff at SFLC during September. I really did.
Okay.
It was getting everything transitioned over to everyone else, all the projects that I was working on at SFLC. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of stuff to do there. I didn't do all that much. I mean, some weekends I did, but.
No, but I mean, looking forward, Conservancy can ramp up. That's great.
Yeah, that's true. But it's been, I've been catching up from the September materials, mostly stuff that's been delayed since, a lot of stuff was delayed from September that I still haven't completely finished.
But not going forward.
Hopefully not. Who knows? It could become too big and too much work for all we know.
Well, if it becomes too big, maybe you can hire somebody else.
I hope so.
That'd be fun.
It would be nice, but we need donations for that, unfortunately. Not unfortunately, but that's the only way we can do it, is more donations.
So I'll just say it again. Donate to the Software Freedom Conservancy, which is a 501c3, but also donate to the Software Freedom Law Center.
So also, have we thought about what if people want to donate to our podcast? We don't have a nonprofit. They can't donate to us right now.
I think they should donate to either the Conservancy or actually they should split it, even if it's a small donation, and give a small amount to Conservancy and a small amount to the Software Freedom Law Center.
Yeah, on the other hand, Conservancy barely has one employee. SFLC has many employees.
It's true, but it means that we're doing a lot and making the most of limited resources. They're both great organizations.
So both worthy of donations. So you don't think we need any funding?
And we won't be too upset if you donate to the FSF either, even though.
Well, I'm a director of the FSF, so I want you to give the FSF.
I'm an associate member of the FSF.
I'm associate member number one of the FSF.
I don't know what my number is, but it's high.
Yeah, well, we didn't reuse any of them. That was the whole idea.
Yeah. But
there's been talk about abandoning that numbering thing.
You don't want them to.
I don't want them to because I'm number one. I guess if it's too much work to maintain, it's not that worth it.
And I give legal advice to the FSF, so.
So I guess if you want to support us, that's how you do it. I guess we don't need to ask for support for our podcast.
I don't think so.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, well, not when there are so
I'll
many.
Keep paying
not
for
when
the
there are great organizations.
Domain name. That's fine.
And I'll keep providing my apartment. Broadcasting from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And we'll do it again next time. Reason Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. That's licensed under CC by ND 3.0 US. The rest of Reason Freedom is licensed under CC by SA 3.0 Unported.
Hear that buzz?
That's what I don't hear it now.
Well, we don't hear it, I guess.
They'll hear it.
Well,
hopefully.
This is what the whole
hopefully or not hopefully.
This is what the whole episode would have sounded like last time.
Annoying.